But from an academic standpoint, the last in our series on church government, or should I say, you know, working together or not being rebellious against God, the last time we did a survey of the New Testament, especially the book of Acts, and we noted how the apostles that Jesus Christ called and ordained worked well together, and those who came afterwards, Paul, Silas, Barnabas, and others, also worked well together. And when there were controversies, when there were disagreements, when there was a policy, start something new or do something different, they were able to meet together and determine that with God's direction. The first thing I want to ask today is, what was the form of organization in the Old Testament system, the time when the people of Israel were in the Promised Land after Joshua had given them victory there? Well, let's go over to 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 12. 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 12. It's interesting that as needs changed or as things progressed in the history of Israel, the organization also changed to accommodate. In 1 Samuel chapter 12, though, the way God originally had intended it, and as we'll see later, a pattern that is the way He intends us to be in the time of the Church of God, the Church of Jesus Christ, is that there was a king over them called God, that God was to be their king. Originally, they had not intended to have a physical human king over them. In 1 Samuel 12 and verse 12, Samuel is addressing Israel. He says, "When you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us when the Lord your God was or already was your king.'" So he said, "Look, God was already your king. But because of your lack of faith, you chose a man to be your king instead of God." Verse 13, "Now therefore, here is the king," speaking of King Saul, "whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. Take note, the Lord has set a king over you." So the original form of governance, to use those terms, was that Jesus Christ, or the God of the Old Testament, who was the God of the Old Testament, was the God over Israel. And He was to be the king over them. Now, I want to go back and look at how this originally worked out. Let's go back first to Exodus chapter 4. In the beginning of the book of Exodus, the people of Israel are in slavery. They're in slavery in Egypt. They'd been there 215 years. It was time for them to be brought out, the 430 years from the time that Abraham crossed the river Euphrates and came into the Promised Land, was about to be up. So in Exodus chapter 4, God called Moses for a specific responsibility, a specific job, which was to bring this, you know, rattletrap bunch of slaves who had lost the sense of their past, who had certainly lost the sense of their God, and who had lost a lot of their identity, to bring them out and to forge them into God's nation. And of course, Moses was a little bit hesitant to do this. But in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 14, it says, "The anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses," because Moses had said, "Send somebody else. I don't want this job." He said, "Is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak. And look, he's also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. I'll be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall say. So he shall be a spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth to you, and you shall be to him as God." Now, the way it worked out, it seems like a little bit later, Moses kind of regained his composure and his strength. In fact, he grew in faith, but sounds like Moses himself addressed Pharaoh pretty much after the first meeting. But to begin with, it was certainly Aaron. So God gave Moses this commandment that he was to do this job and bring these people out of Egypt. Now let's go over to Numbers chapter 12 and verse 7. Numbers chapter 12 and verse 7. Since it was a very specific job that had to be done, Moses was the man God called to do it. He raised him up. You might say he was one sent. So I suppose we could use the words apostle. But he was one sent. Let's start in verse 6 of Numbers chapter 12. You're very familiar with this. This is the story of Miriam and Aaron, who were speaking against Moses. They were a little jealous of his authority and thought they should have some of it. Verse 6, the Lord spoke, he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known to him in a vision or speak to him in a dream. But not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I will speak with him face to face, even plainly and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of God." So God validated Moses' calling and what God had for him to do. But as the needs of Israel grew, Moses realized, I can't handle everything. I've got to duplicate myself, so to speak. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 18 and verse 21. If you look at the parallel with Mr. Armstrong, it's fairly simple. Mr. Armstrong was called out by God to raise up a church where there had not been one before. And then as the work grew and as the church grew, he realized he had to start a college to train ministers because there was a need to replicate himself. The congregations couldn't grow and prosper as long as there was only one minister. But notice Exodus chapter 18 and verse 21. These men were to be judges. Verse 20 says, "You shall teach them statutes and laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do." Never forget that Moses' first calling was to be a teacher, to teach them God's statutes and God's laws. And God still has teachers today with the same responsibility to teach people about the truth of God. "Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God." Now, this would be nice if this were the qualifications to run for president. I thought it was interesting this week that Stephen Colbert tried to run for president in South Carolina. For those of you who don't know who he is, he's Tony Rowe's favorite comedian on TV, and they were watching his show some. But he tried to run for president, and he was turned down, they say, because he wasn't a real candidate, but I think the real reason was because he might have actually won the primary there. There's some thought that he might really win the primary in South Carolina, and that would embarrass the other candidates, but who knows. The truth of the matter is there are hundreds and hundreds of people who want to be in office in this country, but wouldn't it be great if we had this as the four qualifications, if these were the qualifications they have to meet? First, they have to have the ability. Second, they have to be men who fear God, who truly fear to disobey God. Men of truth. Wow. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had men of truth ruling this country today? Hating covetousness. They would not take a bribe. They wouldn't take anything, give any favors for money. And place them as such to be rulers over thousands, rulers over hundreds, rulers over fifties, and rulers over tens. And let them judge the people at all times. So they were there to make judgments based upon God's law. So if, you know, Sam and Fred had a controversy, they could make the judgment. And only the most serious matters would have to be brought before Moses. So they were the judge case to judge these cases. So Moses sort of replicated himself, so to speak. Now I want to go over to Numbers chapter 34. As we begin to look at the process of going into the promised land, the process of how God led these people in the wilderness for 40 years, out of Egypt first, and then into the promised land, we find that as they went to the promised land, the land was to be divided up. It was to be divided up by two people. I could ask for a show of hands who the two people were, but I won't. The two people who divided them up were Eliezer and Joshua. There were the priests, who were the sons of Aaron, then Eliezer, later his son, and then his son after him. And there was, secondly, the civil head, or you might say the Joshua, the military leader. Later in the history of Israel, those two responsibilities were not separated. In fact, King Saul committed a grievous crime by offering a sacrifice in place of Samuel because he thought Samuel didn't get there soon enough. Also, King David was aghast that King Saul at one time had killed some priests or had some killed. I think Doeg did it. And the responsibility of the priests was always separate. But in Numbers chapter 34 and verse 16, let's look at how these things were divided up. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "These are the names of the men who shall divide the land among you as an inheritance. Eliezer the priest, and Joshua, the son of Nun." Now, Eliezer was the guy that had what they called the Urim and the Thummim. It was his breastplate upon which there were 12 stones, 12 different colors of stones, each one representing a tribe of Israel. And so when God would ask God a question as to which tribe would go up first in the battle, they would go and inquire of the priest, and he would inquire of God, and one of these stones would light up, almost like it had a light bulb inside of it. And that would tell them which tribe was to do this or to do that responsibility. Under this little Urim, or this little pouch, this breastplate was a pouch, kind of like a little pocket or something. And they would have what were in there called lots. Now the lots, some believe they were round stones, two different colors, like four or five black stones and one white. Or perhaps they were sticks, little sticks of wood a certain length, several of equal length, and the one that was longer. And so they would then throw them on the ground and ask God to guide and direct what the answer would be. So Eliezer was the one who would cast the lots, and then Joshua would interpret them, or at least would make the decision then, as to which tribe would receive which piece of land, because the property they were going to inherit was already fairly well surveyed. Notice verse 18, "You shall take one leader of every tribe to divide the land for the inheritance." So Joshua then assigned a leader of each tribe of Israel and said, "Then you are the leader. You will have to apportion the land out and set the landmarks," which were big rocks set on the corner of each one of these pieces of land, "according to the heads of the families of that tribe." And these men are, by the way, listed. The names of the men from the tribe of Judah were Caleb. Of course, he was the oldest man there, the only one left other than Joshua from the original spies who spied out the promised land. And the tribe of Simeon had Shemuel. And from the tribe of Benjamin, Eldidad, so your Eliadad, and all of these men are mentioned. Verse 29, "These are the ones the Lord commanded." So God himself was behind this command. The command came through Eliezer and Joshua to divide the inheritance among the children of Israel in the land of Canaan. And so these men were then to divide the land up and give each family its own piece of land. And that land was to be theirs in perpetuity. So that even if they lost it through, you know, drought or through famine or through some sort of demise or perhaps even just bad judgment, within 50 years, at the very maximum, there would be the Jubilee year and all the land would come back to their original families. Now, it would be great if we did this today. Some of us would inherit, you know, land probably, as opposed to what most of us inherit today from our ancestors or our parents. It would be great to have a piece of land, but they all had one. Now let's go over to see how this was carried out. Let's go to Joshua chapter 11. Get over at Joshua chapter 11. As Joshua began to bring the people into the promised land, they began to understand that they had a responsibility. Responsibility to take that land and to obey God. God didn't just give it to them, he gave them title to it. But they had to then carry it out and take it. Joshua chapter 11, beginning in verse 16. "Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, the land of Goshen, the lowland, and the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel, and its lowlands." Now, if I were real good with PowerPoint, like Mr. Johnson, I could be up here with a pointer here and a map, and I could show you all these places where they were. There are some decent Bible atlases, and in the back of some Bibles there are even some maps that give you a, kind of a rough estimate as to where these tribes had their land. They're sort of done in different colors and different maps, and it's worthwhile to look at. Because the book of Joshua does give us some very good donations, or at least notations of where these places were. Verse 17, "From Mount Halak, and the ascent to Mount Seir," which is the area where Petra is, "even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, below Mount Hermon," so all the way to the north, "he captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made a long war with all their kings." Now, the best estimate we have of how long this war of Joshua was in the book of Judges is about 5 years. So it took about 5 years for Joshua to lead these people, lead these armies, from the time that he crossed into the Jordan Valley and took the city of Jericho until essentially the land was subdued. That was about 5 years' time. Verse 19, "There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites and the inhabitants of Gibeon," maybe the ones that pretended to be travelers from a far country and deceived Joshua. "Now all the others they took in battle, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. At that time, Joshua came and cut off the Anakim of the mountains. That would be the descendants of David and Goliath. I'm sorry, of Goliath. Actually, it would be the ancestors of Goliath, not the descendants. This is before David's time. So there were some children, there were some giants or big guys who lived there in the land, and most of them were defeated and cut off by Joshua. Now let's go over to chapter 15. Joshua chapter 15 and verse 1. And it must have been an exciting time. The people of Israel who had been slaves, their ancestors had been slaves. This generation was born in the wilderness, or if they were under 20 years old at the time, they actually had been slaves in Egypt, so some were really Egyptians by nationality. So they came out and were going into this fabulous land where they could now settle it. They could have their own farms, their own homes, their own vineyards. They could raise their families in peace, and that was a great time. In chapter 15 and verse 1, so this was the lot of the tribe of the children of Judah according to their families. So this describes the border of the people of Judah. The border of Edom in the wilderness of Zin southward was the extreme southern boundary. So they're down around the Dead Sea area, where one of their boundaries is on the east. Their southern border began at the shore of the Salt Sea. We know where that is, the Dead Sea, from the bay that faces southward. And then it went out to the southern side of the ascent of Akabim, passed along to Zin, ascended on the south side of Kadesh Barnea, passed along to Hezron, went to Adar, and went around from Karkah. From there it passed towards Amzon and went out to the brook of Egypt. So they had a huge section, Judah did, of the southern area of the promised land. Verse 5, the east border was the Salt Sea as far as the mouth of the Jordan. So from the very top of the Dead Sea down to the bottom was the border of the land of Judah. So they had a pretty good sized border there and a pretty good sized area that the land of Judah took over. And of course, down in verse 16, we find Caleb. In verse 14, Caleb drove out the three sons of Anak from there. Caleb was a real aggressive type guy. He had spent 40 years waiting for the day when he could conquer the land that would belong to the people of Judah. And so the story of his little fight here in Joshua chapter 15, you just have to kind of admire the guy that he waited all those years and never lost his desire to take that land and do what God had commanded him. Now let's go over to chapter 18, Joshua 18. Here we have an interesting story. Because these people were promised this beautiful promised land, they were promised, and they could just go take it. Just had to fight a little bit for it. They had to decide to go up and do it. This was the first area of rest. Hebrews chapter 4 tells us that Joshua gave them this temporary rest, but that it was a type of the future rest, the kingdom of God, that we are all called to. And it says, there remains therefore a keeping of the Sabbath day, which reminds us that there is a rest, a promised land remaining for all of us. But some of the tribes became lethargic. Perhaps they already had a nice little home, and they had a place to plant their garden. And so they grew a little bit, just sort of lazy, you might say, spiritually speaking. You know, the book of Hebrews warns us not to neglect our calling, not to have ourselves just sort of fall into disrepair spiritually and fail to make it to God's kingdom. So there's a spiritual, an encouragement for all of us, a prodding. Chapter 18 and verse 1 of Joshua says, the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting. So the wars were over, at least the major part of the war was over. They began then to set up the tabernacle where the priests could teach, where they could have the feast days every year. They could keep the Passover, unleavened bread, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles, all the fall feasts. The land was subdued before them. But there remained among the children of Israel seven tribes which had not yet received their inheritance. These men should have. They were waiting for somebody else to do it. They were kind of waiting for Joshua to do it. Joshua said to the children of Israel, how long will you neglect to go and possess the land which the Lord your God has given you? Now, how long will you neglect salvation, we might ask ourselves. Pick out from among you three men for each tribe. I will send them. They shall rise and go through the land, survey it according to their inheritance, and come back to me, and they shall divide it into seven parts. And so Joshua told them, look, you survey the land, we will divide it up. so that he and the priest Eleazar could divide up the land according to the lots. And then in verse 8, the men arose to go away. Joshua charged those who went away to survey the land, saying, "Walk through the land, survey it, come back to me that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord in Shiloh." So God was still making the decisions. The God of the Old Testament, the one who became Jesus Christ, was there leading and guiding the decisions, but the people had to have their own effort. They had to say, "We are going to follow God, we're going to obey and do what he said," and they had to put their foot out and actually make the effort to take the promised land. It was not going to be given to them unless they made the appropriate effort. Now I want to look at how these landmarks were put together. First, let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Deuteronomy chapter 19. As they conquered the promised land, they put a rock at the corner of each one of these pieces of land so that they know where the border was. They knew where these demarcations were. This is the landmark, they were called. Today we use a metal rod. Sometimes it has a little stamp on top of it, or sometimes they use something similar. But for the most part, we still use surveyor's marks that are very similar to these. It was a serious crime to move somebody else's landmark. Now today we have legalized theft in the form of what's called adverse possession. Your neighbor can fence in your property, and after 7 years he can call it his. Even though you're still paying taxes on it, you can't kick him off. It's got to be the most ridiculous law anybody ever came up with. But that's what we have in our country. Back at this time, Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 14, God said, "You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is given you to possess." So the landmarks could not be removed. When God gives somebody land, it is their land. And no one else has the right to steal that or give it to somebody else. This is repeated, by the way, in a similar way over in Deuteronomy chapter 27. Let's go back over to Deuteronomy chapter 27 and begin in verse 17. In this case, this is, of course, the blessings and cursings. The people of Israel were to divide up on two mountains, Mount Ebal for the cursings and Mount Gerizim to say the blessings. And they were to actually yell back and forth that people would be cursed if they moved these landmarks. Deuteronomy chapter 27, in verse 13, "These shall stand on Mount Ebal to curse Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali." Now, these, by the way, I believe were the children of the concubines, not the actual wives of Israel, but that's another story. Verse 15, "Cursed is the one who makes a carved or molded image, an abomination to the Lord, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and sets it up in secret. All the people shall answer and say, Amen. Cursed is the one who treats his father and mother with contempt." So these are very, very serious crimes. And then verse 17, "Cursed is the one who moves his neighbor's landmark." So the landmark could not be moved without a curse being placed upon that person. And just to make the lesson very, very strong, they were to get up every year and yell this back and forth to each other to remind them of it. I want to look at some of the admonitions. Now let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 31. As Moses was preparing to die and wrote the last book here, the summary of what God had been doing through them, the laws he'd given to them, and Moses' last will and testament, so to speak, in this book of Deuteronomy, he mentioned here that they would all have a responsibility to worship God on their own, that God was to be their king. And I think he's preparing them for the time when Joshua dies, because Joshua had no successor. Joshua's commission was to go into the promised land to conquer the nations that were there and deliver the land to the people of Israel. But after that, there was no even military leader. Well, there were judges raised up during times of crisis beyond that. But essentially, there was to be no successor to Joshua. In Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 1, "Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel. He said to them, I'm 120 years old. I can no longer go in and come out. The Lord has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan. The Lord your God himself crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Lord has said, and the Lord will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and their land when he destroyed them. The Lord will give them over to you, that you may do them according to every commandment which I have commanded you. Notice, be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid, for the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. So Moses is telling them their leader was to be God. He will not leave you nor forsake you. You know, what did Jesus Christ say right before he ascended to heaven in the end of the book of Mark? He said, I will not leave you or forsake you. Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage. But notice what Joshua's commission is. You must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. Joshua wasn't a king. Joshua wasn't, in practical fact, a judge. Joshua was a military leader. Certainly he took over the responsibility of judging Israel after Moses died, but his real job was to go in, kick out the inhabitants of the land, and to give Israel the inheritance that God had promised them. Verse 8, the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. So the responsibility was Joshua's to go in, but the leader was to be God. So Moses wrote this law and delivered to the priests. It probably includes everything from Genesis through Deuteronomy. Certainly it is the book of Deuteronomy. The priests, the sons of Levi, who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. So we have the priests, whose job it was to teach God's laws, to read the Bible, to administer the feasts, the sacrifices, all the things that were to be done around the tabernacle, and also to make judgments based upon God's law when there was a controversy, especially controversies about things like mold in the house or some other things that, like leprosy, that the Bible tells them they had to do. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, so this land Sabbath year, at the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, the appointed time is the Day of Atonement. That's when the year is proclaimed, either the land Sabbath year or the 50th year, the Jubilee year. And then you have the Feast of Tabernacles. During the Feast of Tabernacles, this book of Moses and all that he wrote was to be read to all the people of Israel, because they had to be reminded that God was their God, and each one of them had a responsibility to follow him, that God was their king, not a man being their king. When all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women, little ones, and the stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear and they may learn to fear the Lord your God and carefully observe all the words of this law. So the law was to be read to everyone, because everyone was to be responsible to God, and everyone was to be responsible to obey God, especially the men were to be the head of their houses. And let's drop down, or the head of their family. Let's drop down now to verse 22. Therefore Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel. Then he inaugurated Joshua the son of Nun, and said, be strong and of good courage. Notice Joshua's commission again. For you shall bring the children of Israel into the land of which I swore to them, and I will be with you. So it was when Moses had completed the words of the law in the book, when they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites who bore the Ark of the Covenant, saying, take the book of the law, put it inside the Ark of the Covenant with the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness to you. So this book was finished, and the commission to Joshua was known to all, so all the people there. They knew the job that he had to do, and that was to bring them into the promised land. I want to go over to Joshua now, chapter 23. Joshua was the one who carried out this commission. But we find that before Joshua died, he reminded all the people of Israel that every one of them was to be subject to God, and that it was to be a one-on-one relationship in the sense that God was to be their king, and they were not to have a king over them. Joshua 23, in verse 1, it came to pass, a long time after the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua was advanced in old age. And Joshua called for all Israel. Notice, everyone is brought together, not just a few select. He had their elders, their heads, their judges, all their officers. He said, I'm old, I'm advanced in age. You have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord is your God, and it is He who has fought for you. So Joshua reminds him, look, God has been on your side. He is your God. He tells all of them that. And He is the one who has fought for you. See, I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes from the Jordan with all the nations that I have cut off as far as the great sea westward. The Lord your God will expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight. And so you shall possess their land as the Lord your God promised you. Therefore, be very courageous to keep and do all that's written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside to the right hand or to the left. Now let's drop down to chapter 23. Joshua again gathers all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. So they're all brought together. Now what was at Shechem? Well, Shechem was the place of Jacob's well. It's where the well was dug. It's where Jacob had seen this vision of the angels going back and forth on a ladder up to heaven, and where God had made a covenant with him that he would then have all his seed would have the possession of this land, and his seed would go on forever. All the blessings that God gave to Abraham were passed on to him there. So it was an historical place where the covenant was confirmed to the descendants of Abraham. So Joshua gathers all the tribes of Israel together at Shechem to sort of confer on them. Now look, you are going to inherit some of these promises to Abraham, and here is your responsibility. It says, he called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the son of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river. Well, that's the Euphrates River. And recall that Abraham was called out of that and came to this side. In old times, and they served other gods. I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants, and gave him Isaac. So here at the place where the covenant had been renewed before, Joshua is now reiterating, or once again giving and rehearsing the covenant to them. So I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt, according to what I did among them. And afterwards I brought you out. Then I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and came to the sea. And the Egyptians pursued them with chariots. So they cried out to the Lord, and of course he rehearses some of these things that were done. Let's drop down a little bit farther to about verse 13. I have given you a land for which you did not labor. They simply walked into it. They conquered the people who were there, drove them out. In some cases, they didn't have to conquer them. God sent bees or hornets in there to drive them out. And they simply walked into vacated houses and cities and vineyards and gardens they could simply harvest. Said, you eat of the vineyards and olive groves of which you did not plant. Now therefore, fear the Lord your God, serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Now, on the other side of the river, the Euphrates, the ancient Ur of the Chaldees in Babylon, a few centuries later, was a moon-worshipping society. It's very well documented in history. You can research that. It's in a number of the commentaries. And today, that religion of moon worship comes down to us in the form of Muhammad's teaching, because he simply adopted the religion of ancient Babylon, where they worship the moon god of Arabia, and turned a lot of those ideas into what he teaches, what his followers teach today. These little moon crescent on top of the mosques is one sign of that. Now, the real problem they have, of course, is that we've been to the moon. We brought back pieces of it. It is a rock. It is not a god. And so when you're worshiping something that's been proven to be a rock, not a god, I think you've got an inherent problem. But that's not my problem. It's just kind of interesting observation. So, if somebody sent a rocket to heaven and brought back part of God, I mean, this is not possible, but you know what I mean. It's just ridiculous that they worship what they thought was a god back in the pre-dawn ages or early ages of time, 3,000, 4,000 BC. And it's been proven now to be a rock, not a god, so they've got a real problem with it, but someday that'll be dealt with. Now, in Egypt, they worshipped the sun. So you had moon worshipping on one side of the Euphrates, you had sun worship on the other in Egypt. And of course, that sun worship has come down to us today in many, many forms, and we'll see some of that carried out here in a couple months, a month and a half. So he says, don't serve either the moon or the sun, but serve the Lord. If it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. So the emphasis here on Joshua's last words are, you are responsible. You are responsible to God. You must make a choice whom you are going to worship. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's what Joshua told them. You can decide whom you want. But see, God was their king. And they all had to make a choice what God they were going to serve. The gods of the sun or the moon or the true God. The people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. So they promised over and over, as Joshua was giving his last words, that they would serve God, that they would make the right decision. Let's drop down to verse 19. You cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins if you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods. He said, he'll punish you. So in verse 21, they argued with him. No, we will serve the Lord. Unfortunately, it only lasted about a generation or less, and they turned out not to be serving the Lord. But these people, I believe, when they said this, were very likely very sincere. The important thing is, at the end of Joshua's book, there is no successor to Joshua. There was a time and a need for a government under Moses. And God has often used one man sent to do a job who will then carry out that job. That doesn't mean that as time continues, that every form of government or every form of organization of God's people has to fit into this virtual papacy or one-man rule type thing. You know, the word apostle means one sent. Mr. Armstrong was sent to raise up a church where there was not one. In fact, after we get done with this, I'm going to start into the book of 2 Corinthians and just take that sort of in a Bible study sermon type format. 2 Corinthians is about Paul's relationship with his congregation. It's the best description and template we have in the Bible of how Paul dealt with the people in his congregations. There are some personal items in there where he'd been accused. But as a pattern of how we ought to be not only organizing today, but also having a relationship with those whom God has given the responsibility to teach us, and our own individual responsibility perhaps is the best book that we have. But in that book, he shows the signs of an apostle, and if you boil it down, it is that an apostle was sent to raise up a church where there had not been one before. Now, Mr. Armstrong was used to do that. The Church of God Seventh Day was in complete political disarray. They were watering down their doctrines horribly and refused to teach doctrines they had acknowledged were true, such as the truth about the United States and Britain being the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. And I remember back in Oregon one time I baptized a former Church of God Seventh-day pastor and he'd resigned from them because they had made an announcement in 1984 that all new converts to their church would not be required to abstain from clean and unclean meats. They thought that was too much of a burden for new people coming into their church. They wanted to let them go ahead and eat pork and shellfish and whatever. And Mr. Bentz, who was a pastor over in Idaho, had moved over to McMinnville, Oregon. And when he called me on the phone, I probably told you a story before, but God healed him of his broken leg. But at any rate, a broken hip. But he just, had said he couldn't do it any longer because they had turned against what he knew to be truth that God wants us to obey. So whenever church leadership turns like that, then God has to raise up a new church, a new era of his church. And so God used Mr. Armstrong in that way, and the church grew and became very large, became a almost worldwide church. I hate to use that term, but it certainly was in every country on the face of the earth. But as time goes on and there is no longer a need for one to be sent, if someone else simply takes over and manages what has already been built, they are not an apostle. And when people who came after Mr. Armstrong decided to proclaim themselves apostles based not on any evidence or any fruit or any biblical evidence or any biblical reason, but simply because they wanted to, it was difficult for those of us that understood 2 Corinthians to go along with it. And I remember one time I was asked to get up in church just back in 1987 and announce that somebody else was now an apostle. And I said, it's not true. It's not the case, because here's what the requirements are. And, it's simply not true. He's not an apostle. And that was one of the many times I got myself in trouble for saying what I thought was true and right and correct instead of being politically towing the line. So I think in the evidence in subsequent years has proven that I was right, but that doesn't mean I was right. It means God was right, and I simply, on that case at least, agreed with him. But the important thing here is that we end the book of Joshua. We see that God wanted to be the king of these people. Verse 24, the people said to Joshua, "The Lord our God we will serve, and his voice we will obey." And God inspired Joshua to set up monuments to remind them. They had yearly reminders. They had the Levites to remind them. And for a while, that generation did obey God. And that was the way God wanted it, for every family to have him as their king. But they had priests who were to teach them the laws, who were to read them the law, who were to make sure they had organized church services, organized feasts to go to, organized sacrifices around the temple at that time. And they were also to have judges who would make some judgments based upon God's law. But everyone was to rely on God as their king. Now let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, because the New Testament has some of the exact same wording. Jesus Christ did not ordain Peter to be a pope. Paul never said that he inherited anything from Peter. Peter was given a commission. He was sent to Jews to raise up a church of Jews where there was not one before. And the evidence in history is that he went to Babylon to a very, very large colony of Jews and raised up a church there where there had not been one before. Paul was sent to Gentile areas, Asia Minor and Greece, and later to Rome, and perhaps areas north of there, to raise up churches where there had not been any before. In 1 Corinthians 11, in verse 1, the Apostle Paul says, "Imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things, and keep their traditions, keep the teachings, just as I deliver them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ." Just like the way Joshua had it organized. The head of every man was to be the God of the Old Testament, the one we now call Jesus Christ. I want you to know that every man, his head is Jesus Christ. The word man is obviously inclusive. It means women too. But the head of the woman is man. It's a little slightly different wording. But it means that she's to be in conjunction with him, following God. This is not being used to mean that some God is, you know, that we men are somehow gods to our wives. That's been misconstrued over the years. It just means that they're work together, and of course she's to honor her husband in that office. And the head of Christ is God. That Christ and God are two separate entities, but certainly the head of Christ is God. And Jesus Christ said many times, especially in the book of John, that he did what his Father asked him to do and spoke his Father's words. Then in verse 4 through verse 16, he says, "Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head." So he's simply talking about hair length, because down later it describes the covering here as being hair and hair length. And so there was to be a delineation that we were to show that we honor God, that he was our head, by the way that we act and the way that we acknowledge him. So we have these, I think, pretty striking similarities between the way that this was organized by Joshua and later under the apostles. Now, I want to go back to Ephesians. Let's go back to Ephesians chapter 5. The role that the ministry today plays is the same as the Levites played back in their time, in the sense that we teach the truth, we organize the church services, we help in areas and ways that we are commissioned to help in and to teach in. It's not a matter of being a king or an owner. The words in the Greek are really more guide, teacher. There's one in Hebrews chapter 13 we read that perhaps has a little more sort of authoritative connotation to it, in the sense that they have the authority to deal with heretics and those who are teaching incorrect knowledge. But in Ephesians chapter 5, let's look in verse 23. Another way of saying what he said in 1 Corinthians, "The husband is head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. He is the Savior of the body." Now, how was Christ the head of the church under Joshua? Well, Christ made the decisions. Sure, they cast lots. Today we don't cast lots. We ask God to guide and direct circumstances. They only cast lots one time in the New Testament, and that was before they received the Spirit of God. They did that back in the time with, of course, Matthias. And after that, they simply prayed and asked for God to guide them. But Jesus Christ was there guiding and directing the dividing up of the promised land. He decided who got what land, literally. And we have to have faith today that Jesus Christ is still the head of the church, and that he is helping guide and direct decisions, and that many of the things that are done really do have his inspiration. It's awfully difficult for us to understand it at the time sometimes, especially when our comfort zone is upset. But we really have to understand that Jesus Christ said he would never leave us or forsake us, and that he is still guiding and directing his church. And let's go back over now to chapter 4, Ephesians chapter 4. In verse 11, I want to emphasize two things here. Sometimes we read this and we read the offices and we try to discern them. The two things that are the most important are, number one, that Jesus Christ himself gave. He gave some to be apostles. He called some to that one sent calling. He gave some prophets. Now, those came later. So after Christ ascended to heaven, he was still giving people in the church, people who were called to be prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and some teachers. I would dare say that Jesus Christ has never quit doing this. He is still giving the church pastors and teachers. Some who give inspired preaching. The word prophesying really means inspired preaching. He has some who are evangelists who do a lot of work trying to spread the gospel and evangelize in new areas. But the important thing is that he is still giving those people to us, those offices to us. He is still calling men into his service. Notice verse 12. The purpose is for the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry. In other words, the edifying or the building up, the building of proper knowledge in the body of Christ. The purpose of all these offices, these people, these teachers that he gives to us and has been giving since the time of the book of Acts, is to equip the saints. Now, what are we equipped with? New boots, new shirts, new hats? No, we're equipped with truth and equipped with the character through his Spirit to be able to obey the truth regardless of the circumstances we find ourselves in or the temptations we may face. So we are being equipped to be sons of God. We are being equipped to have that knowledge that it can work in us a marvelous work and a wonder, which is the changing of a physical human being into someone that can someday be a part of God's family in his kingdom. So God gave these offices and these people to us to equip us with knowledge. In the Old Testament, the priests, Levites, read the books. They admonished the people to obey them, but without God's Spirit, those words fell very shallow on their ears. With God's Spirit, those words should keep in our hearts. The new covenant is to write those words in our heart, and God uses his servants today to help that take place. For the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying or the building up of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith. It's a unity of the faith. It's not 50 or 70 or 100 different ideas, each a little bit different. And of the knowledge of the Son of God to a perfect man. Jesus Christ said, "Become you therefore perfect, that you can be like your Father in heaven, who is perfect." The word really means mature, means complete. So the work of the ministry is to help people become complete. It says, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature in fullness of Christ. And that's really what purpose we have. That's why we organize. That's why we have services. That's why we have things done the way that we do. The final object of all of our efforts as God leads us is so that every person that God calls can someday be a perfect individual in his sight. You know, washed clean by the blood of Jesus Christ and mature in the sense of being able to use his word to understand the truth and live their life, fulfilling the first commandment to love God with all of our heart and all of our being. So that is the summary of why we obey God and the summary of why we have organization as we do and what God intends the final purpose for it to be.